Hi, my name is Matt. I'm the founder of Regeneration Projects, a small business that sees two great bays and a river as our most important business partners. We started at a kitchen table during Melbourne's epic COVID-19 lockdown, and now we're a B Corp and actor in the UN decade on ecosystem restoration. As we begin this episode, we'd like to acknowledge the two great bays, Port Phillip and Western Port, which are known to First Peoples as Nam and Wurrumbirrin, or Murrumbik. Without the bays and the Birrarung Yarra River, we wouldn't be in business today. So we show deep respect to First Nations elders, past and present, who for over 60,000 years have cared for the bays, Birrarung, and their catchment areas. Their ecological knowledge inspires us to practice business in partnership with nature. Now, choosing a career that tackles environmental issues like climate change, biodiversity loss, or pollution can be incredibly rewarding, but also super tough. When we listen to the stories of passionate and pioneering professionals, it stokes our inner fire and belief so that we can keep doing the work that we know needs to be done to benefit future generations. That's what the Two Bays podcast is all about. Stories of hope, grit, and determination, inspiring the planet's next generation of ecological leaders and entrepreneurs. This series is made in partnership with the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council and celebrates the stories of business and community champions at the forefront of local climate action. Let's tune in. Womandjika, welcome and come with purpose to the Two Bays podcast. My name's Matt Sykes, and along with Claire Wild, who is absent in this particular episode, so I'm flying solo, we've had the pleasure of journeying around the Mornington Peninsula, stepping in and visiting local champions that are working at the forefront of climate action. We've heard so many different stories from the education space, tourism, agriculture, and much more. And today we are specifically diving into the world of transport, but also hearing some voices from the Shire themselves, the Mornington Peninsula Shire Council, to understand how these actions and initiatives that all of these individuals and organizations are doing with that support through climate grants, as well as off their own back, are contributing to the whole transition and transformation of the region. So as we do, we'll take a moment to acknowledge those connections to country, the Boomerang and the Bunurong peoples, and their living connections to country, particularly those links to the two bays and their catchment areas. Of course, Nerm Port Phillip Bay and Wurrumbirrin or Murrumbik Western Port, these incredible waterways that form the backdrop of not only everyday life, but also everyday business. Joining us today in the podcast, we've got a number of special guests. And Anthony, please excuse me if I don't pronounce this right, but I'm going to have a good go at it. Anthony Broyce van Grenoe, who is the founder and director of the Good Car Company. We also have Lucy Allison, who is the team leader of climate change. Jesse Caulfield, who is the Climate Change Project Officer, who's going to share some specific insights around key projects with some links to transport. And Jackie Salter also joining us, Community Environmental Education Coordinator, who's helped us in so many ways in connecting to local champions across the peninsula. So very grateful that you could all take this time out of your busy schedules and just share and add to this narrative that's really building here, because one of the things that keeps on coming up is this sense that what's happening here on the Mornington Peninsula is not only inspiring for the local area, it's something that is really great for other coastal regions and other regions full stop in Australia and perhaps even internationally as well. Lucy, I'm going to come to you first. As the team leader of climate change at the Shire, how do you see from that overarching strategic perspective the importance of climate action in such a beautiful environment such as the Mornington Peninsula here just outside of Melbourne?
Yes, thank you, Matt. We regard climate change as incredibly important here at the Mornington Peninsula Shire, as we see it presents unprecedented challenges ahead if we don't act on it. And we have committed to very strong action. We have declared back in 2019 a climate emergency. as part of an international movement, and we're very proud of that. But more importantly, we have built on the back of that a climate action plan with strong targets for zero emissions by 2040, which is adopted with our community support and endorsement in 2020. And we're acting on this climate emergency plan. Our beautiful Shire has, you know, this amazing coastline and beaches and this big food bowl and tourism hub. And it's really important for us to really identify and the risks through fire and flood and erosion and work together to find the solutions to adapt to this and build resilience into our Shire.
Couldn't agree more. Anthony, your connection to the Good Car Company, really curious to hear your perspective on the uniqueness of this conversation about climate action on the peninsula as opposed to, let's say, other regions in Australia.
I think there's this beautiful thing of being able to act locally and think globally. There's the opportunity to be able to demonstrate in an area like the peninsula real climate leadership. And obviously it's a beautiful place to do everything you possibly can to be able to maintain the natural values of it. I know cars are probably the antithesis of environmental action, but I think EVs present a real opportunity in the sense that, well, it's better if people can take public transport or ride bikes, but in lieu of that, EVs have far lower emissions profiles. And the amazing thing about them is they're big batteries on wheels. So we're coming much closer to the point where we can actually start to use those big batteries on wheels to be able to support your homes and to be able to feed into the grid as well. So, you know, a back of the envelope calculation, if you had 1 million EVs on the road, which seems like a lot, but really when you look at Greater Melbourne, there are millions and millions of vehicles there. If you had them through bidirectional charging, that would be enough baseload capacity to shut down 2 coal-fired power stations. And it's phenomenal the impact that can have. And I think that when people start to recognize that EVs are so much more, they're basically big batteries and computers on wheels, I think that's really, really exciting.
Absolutely. And I think what the way that you describe that, it really points to this time of transition that we're going through, where it's not only a transition to look at how we use energy and fuel and so on, but it's also a transition of our economy, and the behaviors, the habits, the decision-making processes are starting to factor in other aspects. So I'm looking forward to diving into that a little bit deeper with you. Jesse, perhaps if I come across to you next, you know, through your work in the project initiatives that you're doing, are you able to give us a bit of an introduction to some of the areas that you work across and some of the people that you're also connected to as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Matt. So my sort of primary role at Council is in the design and delivery of the key projects necessary to reach the targets outlined in our climate emergency plan. So I suppose at a sort of broad level, a lot of that's focused on the stationary energy emissions of our community, but also the transport emissions, which I think contribute about just over 30% of our emissions profile. It's actually the second largest contributor. So digging a little bit deeper into that, we've run projects in the transport sector, specifically around increasing the uptake of electric vehicles. We've partnered through the help of federal and state grant programs with some charging providers to install fast chargers in key public hubs around the peninsula. I think we've now got 5 and a 6th in planning. We've also sort of looked inward at our own fleet emissions. We've converted nearly all of our passenger car pool vehicles to electric vehicles. So we're up to 16 now. And we've also developed a transition plan that will look at the electrification of all of our fleet, which includes 4-wheel drives, vans, and some of the vehicles that probably up to now there haven't been necessarily fit for purpose equivalents in electrics. So that's kind of where we stand. We've also done a little bit of community engagement and education in terms of electric vehicle information days, which have been amazingly well attended. That sort of blew us away with just the interest that we got from the community. And then to step away from transport a bit, we're always looking at optimising and promoting renewable energy, so solar, batteries, demand management and optimisation, Yeah, I think that's a little bit of an overview of some of the things we're jumping into.
Thank you, Jesse. And Jackie, if I might pass across to you, you know, this capacity building, this education from an environmental perspective of our broader community, including the business community, is so vital, because it's part of what, when we set these strategic directions and goals, it's everyone kind of coming up and chipping in, because it does take a village, and there's certain roles that the council is able to do, but it really takes everyone chipping in. When you're out there and you're running these programs to be able to empower you know, the citizens of the Mornington Peninsula, what's just an example of some of the key messages that you put forward and that you share?
Yeah, sure. We run a whole suite of environmental workshops for our community and also for schools, and we're really trying to empower everybody to make a difference. And we understand that, you know, people come from different backgrounds, they have different you know, capacity to make those changes. So where they can't, we definitely have programs to be able to support those, you know, vulnerable communities on the peninsula. But for other people, you know, we've really noticed there's a huge interest in the community, and they want to know how they can make changes and where they can make the most difference. They want to join together and do actions, you know, or take action together. So that might be supporting Repower, which is the local community group who are really keen on decarbonising. We run workshops on solar power and batteries, our induction cooktop, how to cook on induction cooktop workshops have really been so popular, so we're running more of them, how to have a healthy home, and then for, you know, renters, how to make your home more comfortable in summer and also in winter. So, you know, those little low cost upgrades that you can do and how to save energy at home. So we really try and support all of our community to decarbonize and also to be healthy and, yeah, comfortable.
Thank you, Jackie. It is certainly one of the themes that we've heard, is that there are so many things that you can do that can support our journey towards a safer climate. And it's about starting, you know, it's just about finding that one thing or that two things that you might start with, and then that progress over perfection approach, where if you try and bite off too much, of course, it can get overwhelming. But if you just start somewhere and perhaps pal up with a couple of others that are trying to do similar things, it really empowers you and enables you to build up over time. Anthony, entrepreneurship is a really key aspect of climate action, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about the journey of starting Good Car Co. Like, literally, just how did it drop into place, and how has it evolved since its inception?
We're probably some of the last people you want to ask about running a business. We started off 5 years ago, three environmental scientists. It was the eve of the election and looked like Morrison was going to get in, and subsequently he did. And we were just looking at how we could actually have some impact, given that we were going backwards on climate action. And so transport being such a high emitter and something that's steadily growing, it seemed like the logical place. So we started out thinking, oh, well, we can just convert older vehicles into electric cars. And so we got an old Toyota Hilux and tried to pull that apart and realized there was a big, big knowledge gap. So we looked at the core things that were holding back adoption of electric vehicles. One was availability, really, really hard to get EVs back in 2019. And the price is still pretty prohibitive for a lot of people, even though they're so much cheaper to run over their lifetime. You've got hugely reduced fuel and maintenance costs, is still that upfront price. So we thought we needed a secondhand market, which didn't exist at the time. So we started importing vehicles from Japan and the UK, where they did have incentives and policies in place to drive EV uptake. And we were able to benefit from their stock of vehicles and bring them over here at a fraction of the price and really kickstart the EV transition. And given that we all come from not-for-profits and environmental science backgrounds, and I'm really interested in policy and how we can get these grassroots movements to be able to shift policy on federal, state and local government levels. By doing these community actions, we've been really successful in being able to make those voices heard and have policies aligned that help bridge the equity gap and really support the uptake of EV. So charging infrastructure and, you know, incentives like stamp duty reduction or the subsidies, which are more targeted towards lower income households who are going to benefit much more from these more affordable forms of transport.
Thanks, Anthony. I'd love to come back to you in a moment and dive into some of the, you know, the stories of people that maybe have crossed that threshold and they've been able to save up and make that transition, because it is something that is quite difficult. But as you say, once you are able to get there, you know, it's perhaps only a matter of time, but there are those benefits that we start to see, and, you know, it influences everyone in the family. Lucy, when you listen to Anthony, his story and his own leadership journey, I'm curious to pass to you and just to, you know, to look at someone like yourself that's playing a key role as a team leader inside an organization. How has your, you know, personal journey evolved in this climate space to kind of like a grow not only in your knowledge of climate, but your ways of connecting with people and supporting that collective impact, I suppose, because without people who are able to, you know, rally the troops and inspire, it's hard for these things to organize and happen. But when we do get, you know, those leaders that put their hands up and they really support and empower others around them, it benefits everyone involved. Would you be able to share a little bit about your own journey of how you got to where you are and that connection to climate?
Absolutely. And it's a very passionate area for me. I come from a community activation background, and I never cease to be just amazed by how many wonderful people there are out there in the community that just surprise you. They put their hands up, they come up with ideas, they make things happen, and I don't think we can ever underestimate that. But more importantly, we can't do it without doing it all together. And that... that community generosity is going to be really important. We need to share learning. We need to share fears. We need to share this whole element of the transition, because that shared learning is going to be critical for people to understand where their benefits lie. And, you know, I actually personally think we've got some tough things we have to do, but they're quite doable. And if you think long term, particularly, the actual benefits are just so much better for us all. You know, if we want to improve our building quality because they're not good enough, well, we're going to end up more comfortable. If we want to try and use renewable energy, well, we're going to end up with lower costs to exist. You know, you want to plant a tree so it's not so hot in your garden. Well, that whole beautiful natural environment comes to play when it might not have been there. And then this resilience thing where we have to understand the scenarios that are coming our way. Well, as a business, if you can model it and work through it, you'll end up with a service that's more resilient and is more what your community needs. So I just think there's such a win for everyone here. And I think the community are a really important part of that. And I'm sure Jackie might talk to our climate action grants, where they've clearly demonstrated some of their innovation in that area.
Let's go straight there, Jackie, because, you know, we've heard through the making of this series that there are so many people that, you know, it's just been a grant, and it's amazing how that can really trigger and inspire and also catalyze action. Almost the idea of having the grant makes people think, what can I do? Is there just one particular story that you might be able to share where you've seen a bit of a transformation within a specific individual team, and that's been catalyzed by the grant process?
Yeah, we've had some really great responses and really innovative projects that have come about because of the climate, or through the Climate Action Grant program, which is available to not just community groups but also to businesses and to schools as well. There's so many good examples. One that I'm quite excited about is the Southern Sea Greens project. So they are really passionate about capturing carbon through aquatic plants because they really do have a great potential for sequestering carbon. So they applied and were successful in a grant to set up a seaweed laboratory in Germana, and it was quite a new thing. It hadn't been done. It was really just, you know, testing it to see if they could cultivate these kelp spores, yep, and seedlings in the laboratory, and they were, so they were able to seed these lines and put them out in Flinders, and it's been a really, really successful project. And so they're now able to use that seaweed commercially and go onto a much bigger scale.
Thanks, Jackie. Jesse, just to come across to you, you know, someone that, you know, is sitting in your position, you're obviously drawing on a wealth of knowledge and experience. And what we often notice is that in people's home lives, that's also reflected in the decisions that they make themselves, and also, you know, their relationship to, you know, their families and their friendship circles, because often you become such a resource for others around you. Is there something that you frequently share with people, with friends or family, that helps them get started or helps them make a more informed decision in this intersection between climate action and transport?
Yeah, one of the useful things that I think we've done as a team here and as an organisation is to develop learning resources that we can refer people to. Often I find in my family and in my friendship groups, they probably get a bit sick and tired of me badgering at them all the time to make a change. Whereas if I can point them to a third party resource that someone else has developed, they're often much more receptive. So an example of that is we've set up a dedicated electric vehicle landing page on our Shire website, with, you know, links to, I think, the Good Car Company might have a link there perhaps, and the Electric Vehicle Council, and yeah, other things. So I think that'd be kind of my comment there.
Yep, I hear you. I think I might be the same person in our family. And it's a hard hat to wear sometimes, but it's funny seeing the transition. Nephews, let's say some of my older nephews as an example, and I know, you know, when they were a bit younger, they heard their uncle banging on about climate this and regeneration this and whatnot, but then they continue on their own lives and they start developing those reference points and those other independent points of learning. And it's amazing how it shifts. You know, with parents as well, seeing the little things that they think about, because it, you know, that I always reflect that we spend so much time working in professional environments and then, you know, in our own homes, they could be some of the trickiest conversations that we can have. But it's also part of that broader transformation of our community, and we are all growing together. Anthony, if we come back to you, you know, listening to some of these stories, these personal examples, is there a story or a typical scenario that you see where it might be a family, it might be a young couple, it might be retirees, and they're wondering, all right, well, look, we've got this, you know, traditional, conventional car, but we are ready to start looking into this next step. And yeah, what would be your tips in guiding them through that process? Or is there someone that you've done that with, even your own family, and how do they go about it?
I think the most important thing for anybody, like, you can get information from whatever source, and finding a trusted source is really important, but that firsthand empirical experiential learning is the best thing that we can possibly do. So getting behind the wheel of an electric car or jumping in one as a passenger and just living with it for a few days is really, I think when most people do that, they realize that they're faster, they're smoother, they're quieter, they don't stink, they're way cheaper to run. And so that transition happens pretty quickly. People convert very, very easily over to EVs. And I think also just talking to your friends, your neighbors, your family who have done it as well, that's probably the most effective tool that we have to be able to get this broader transition happening. And particularly with some of the more complex things, like being able to show what a critical part of our entire footprint transport is. I think a lot of people just kind of externalize liquid fuels that we burn and don't consider that as our energy makeup, but it's a massive part. And so homes and energy combined, that's over 50% of all of our emissions. If you're able to electrify that, which you can with technologies that we have today, you know, we can see a very rapid transformation. We just got to make sure that we're not, you know, every new vehicle on the road, I guess, that have a life of another 9, 10, 20 years on the road, and they'll be putting out emissions during that entire time. So it's really important to be able to try and get people at those decision-making moments in time and provide them with the right sort of information and experiences so that they can make the switch and become advocates for it as well.
Yeah, you can see just the uptake of electric vehicles probably almost in the last 12 months. You've seen such an acceleration and, you know, also a diversity of brands that are putting these options out there, which, going back, if we just use COVID as a marker, going back prior to the lockdowns, I just don't think that we saw as many. But there really has been an acceleration, which is starting to shift the narrative from, you know, are we going to do this, to it's happening, and, you know, let's get on board. We've covered already a lot of territory here. We've talked about some of the issues. We've talked about some of the stories of how your organizations are each contributing this, and even some of the solutions and things that are happening. One thing that would be great to spend a bit more time on is this interdependency of making climate smart choices in a business context, and the way that that benefits not only climate and the environment, but also, you know, businesses themselves. Anthony, I might pass back to you, and Lucy, over to you soon after that.
Yeah, we've seen huge benefit for companies and businesses transitioning over to electric vehicle fleets. Obviously, they save a lot of money on the running costs, but there's also the indirect benefits that they're walking the talk, particularly if they are doing anything in that sustainability space. Like, they're actually having tangible action. The average car on the road puts out 3 tons of CO2 per year, so if you're able to offset that amount, that's pretty amazing. And seeing the role of councils helping to facilitate those processes with putting in charging infrastructure, but the opportunities for other businesses out there, like tourism providers, that are able to put in destination charges so that people can come from outside of the peninsula. Because if you consider where most of the emissions would come from on the peninsula, so much of that would be from tourism, and that scope 3 emissions of people coming and arriving and leaving. If you can facilitate that process for people to come in more sustainable forms of transport and, you know, stay a while and charge and spend money at those places whilst they're charging, then it's a win-win situation for everybody.
Yeah, terrific. Some of the tourism work that we're involved in is certainly seeing that shift in the way that visitors and destinations, communities, tourism operators interact. And it's quite exciting. Lucy, you mentioned early on that tourism is such a major hub for the peninsula, and we do see large numbers of people, you know, visiting often on short trips from Melbourne. I'm curious to understand a little bit more about how you think, and perhaps not overnight, but in time, how this relationship and this collaboration between the tourism industry and climate actors and visitors could really play out and open up new opportunities.
Change can be so scary, but the EVO market is a wonderful market to help us vision this transformational change. Is quite viable, and it has many positives. And even though there might still be some unknowns to it, the people that are adopting it have pride, and they also see really genuine benefits. So I think this EV market is probably one of the most exciting elements of the broad spectrum of what we've got to try and achieve, because it's demonstrating to people that change doesn't have to be scary. It can be good. It has many benefits. And it is that adoption more broadly across the Shire. You're already seeing, I see the Teslas driving up and down the highway, and you're beginning to drive those norms. And I think that will feed through into our tourism space as well, as we start to take pride in being a Shire that is reducing its emissions and is driving them hard. We want to encourage that behaviour in our territory. So I think that normative behaviour will be very important, and the EV market is just a wonderful market to take away the fear and put the positive thinking rather than the negative thinking into the change process.
Yeah, absolutely. And in term, I mean, the EVs are one dimension, and of course, there's other great ways to get around the peninsula as well, with the, you know, the buses being able to access different favorite beaches or wherever it is, the short walk or even cycling. There are some longer paths that are being worked on and envisaged. For the brave, perhaps even the Two Bays track is an absolute classic. That one's a little bit longer walk, but it does demonstrate that sometimes it's not the technological solution, it's the behavior change, and there's so many ways that can play out. Alrighty, so I guess it's amazing the power of hindsight when we think about what we learn and those that are pioneers in their organizations or their communities or their families, and supporting that demonstration by example. But sometimes there are things that if we were to do it again and share a little message to our former self, there could be ways to save time and also to save money. Anthony, curious from your perspective, if you were taking a walk along your peninsula beach and you had the opportunity to be walking alongside your former self going back 10 years or however long, what's one little tip that you'd say, hey, mate, just letting you know, what is it?
I think a really important thing is just to celebrate the wins. But a lot of the time, like I've done a lot of work in community and renewable energy and working in the background for a lot of these projects for sustainability. And I feel like it's really important to do good, but to also be seen to be doing good. Like you've got to lead by example and show that there are ways of being able to run a business. Like we run our business as a social enterprise, and it's really great to be able to try and set that bar for other businesses to come in as well, that we can run a sustainable business. We can make money, and we can channel that money back into doing really great projects as well. So I'm really excited about scaling beyond that. And we've had some fantastic backing from people like Mike Cannon Brooks, who does a lot of work in the space, and he's very fortunate to have a fair bit of money behind him to do that. But he is using that money for good, and I think that's a role that we can have that is really transformational. Politics, being able to influence those decision makers' minds, and in business sense, being able to run businesses which have environmental and social impact as well.
Yeah, and the power of examples, and you know, someone like Mike Cannon Brooks and the leadership that he shows in what he does, it's an example of how there is an increase of not small but also larger investments, and the two being connected, you know, using the power regardless of what we have. Jackie, coming back to you, if there was one little tip that you'd give yourself going back 10 years or more, what would you whisper in your own ear?
I think I would tell myself I'm not alone in my concern for the environment and what's happening, because now I've realized it's not just me. You know, a survey of around 3,000 members of the Mornington Peninsula community, we found out that climate change is their number one concern. That's a really high priority. So that was a really great realization to know that there's many others who are also concerned, but also, you know, we can harness that into action and motivate them to take positive change. Yeah.
Jesse, from your perspective, what do you think is something that you'd pass on as a message to some of those emerging leaders, perhaps in that 15, 16, 17-year-old bracket where they're starting to come into their own sense of identity and they're starting to look at those next, you know, life steps and make choices about their future? And there is a lot going on. It can be a disorientating but also a really exciting time. Is there a little tip that you'd say?
The tip I think I would provide, and this might not relate to everyone, but it's something I learned pretty early on in my professional sustainability journey, is to perhaps separate emotion somewhat from this. It's easy to get a little bit overwhelmed. I think it's important to be passionate, but I mean, everything we're doing, Lucy mentioned before, it has really clear benefits. It's not useful to get unnecessarily emotional, because these things can all be justified. They've got great business cases. They've got great outcomes in terms of resilience. You know, I believe it's the right thing to do. So, yeah, as long as the facts are presented up front and clearly, I think that it's sometimes useful to kind of almost take a step back, separate yourself and present things clearly.
Brilliant. Terrific. Lucy, I guess one of the things that jumped out in a recent episode was where we had some of these young leaders at local primary schools, you know, coming in and sharing their perspective. And there is no doubt that they have incredibly bright futures ahead of them, no matter what path that they take. But if you were talking to some of those young ones in local schools and you were saying, hey, like maybe you know, you could be the next Jane Goodall, or you could be the next Greta Thunberg, or whichever their aspiration is. From your perspective and your own leadership journey, is there something that you think might be good for them to bear in mind?
I am the 60s baby, so my young children tell me that I am potentially the cause of some of this. So I'm trying very hard to counter that. But from a person who has potential to lead, I would say don't ever underestimate the importance of collaboration and the power of people coming together. In the 20 years I've been in this space, I would say I have never seen the impact, and that's a result of multiple different government levels, different private sector, different NGOs coming together with a common cause, and the power of that is enormous. And so collaborate and just dare to do it. Just do it. That would be my advice to those young leaders.
Thank you, Lucy. Just do it. It's an iconic line, and for good reasons. It's been an absolute pleasure to be able to hear from each of your perspectives and understand some of the dynamic between what's going on in the policy and the governance space, and the way that that is enabling, supporting, and interconnecting with some of the entrepreneurship and different models like a social enterprise, where there is that value coming back into the business, but also a significant portion of that value being able to be distributed to other, you know, community stakeholders and so on. We keep hearing the power of starting where you are and making those steps. And Jesse was sharing the importance of, you know, using evidence and reason and logic just to step through methodically, but also combining that with the passion, you know, that people have, and harnessing that from, you know, even from young ages. I think something that we're seeing a pattern grow as we progress through this series is we're really just starting a conversation here, and it builds on the momentum of so many, you know, existing works. But there is something unique that seems to be emerging in this dialogue, and perhaps that sense that you were talking about, Jackie, of feeling alone or not really sure if I'm in my own bubble, my own organization. But we can see this sense that there are so many champions working in their areas, and there's something kind of magical happening on the peninsula. And there's no surprises that the place itself, the bays, the water, the connection to the environment and the lifestyle that people are able to enjoy are just such a big driver of that. And yeah, it's not an understatement to say that there is something unique that of course can empower other regions too. On that note, my name's Matt Sykes, and this has been another episode of the Two Bays Podcast. Jackie, Jesse, Lucy, Anthony, thank you all so much for joining us. Until next time, folks, we'll see you soon. How amazing are those Mornington Peninsula climate champions? Must be something in the water. Against the odds, they're transforming climate anxiety into climate action. Keep your eyes out for new episodes coming soon. So you're feeling inspired and ready to act. What can you do next? Firstly, subscribe to the Two Bays Podcast on your favorite channel. Then visit the Regeneration Project's website for more info about our ecological leadership and strategic consultancy work. Lastly, don't forget to follow Regeneration Projects on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, as well as subscribe to our seasonal newsletter. My name is Matt, and on behalf of Regeneration Projects and the Two Bays, thank you for tuning in, and see you on the next episode of Two Bays, a Business and a Kitchen Table podcast.